Hi, this is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and I'm here today with Robert Fumo, and we're going to talk about his ancestor research and his many trips to Italy, so, and also his book. So welcome, Robert. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
There's so much to unpack in the book, and you have so many interesting stories. So I think I'll start with just asking you, you know, what prompted you to, you know, look back and find the family?
That's an interesting question. First of all, I had a father that was 5'4", with kind of brown hair, and a mother who's 5'2", with brown castaña, they called it. You know, I came out with bright red hair, 6'2", 220 by the time I was 12 years old. So I always was like, what's going on here? What kind of Italian am I? You know, all my relatives, including my one brother, my other brother was redhead. So I was, you know, I kind of started researching this. So I moved to Brazil in 1970. And obviously they speak Portuguese in Brazil. And As I listened to the Portuguese, I realized that I was understanding a lot of it because it wasn't that much different from Italian. So at the end of 2 years, I learned Portuguese. And I said, this is crazy. I'm Italian and I can speak Portuguese better. So I started really getting into the Italian language and trying to learn that. This is long-winded, I hope. Then I moved to Vienna, Austria, which is by car an 8-hour trip to Italy. And I don't know how many times I took that trip. I went down to see my grandmother in this little town my uncle was living at that time. And from there, I was the only person in this family, including nephews and nieces, that had the slightest bit of interest. And I'm sure you've encountered this with a lot of Italian Americans, probably yeah. a lot of my brother was born there. He really didn't have that much of an interest, and his first language was Italian, but he was 15 years older than me. He didn't speak Italian. I did bring him back to the town where he was born. He could barely speak anything. He was 70-some years old at the time. Anyway, so I did my DNA. I said, this, you know, this red hair thing is really getting me. I sent you a picture of
Hair. Well, you know, it's funny. I have a cousin, him and his sister, out of 9 brothers and sisters from my mom's family. And my cousin was Johnny Red. He had red hair. No clue.
My wife is Sicilian. With her, she had no idea, nor did her mother, who was Sicilian, grew up in a Sicilian family in Queens. They really had no idea. And so I started the research for their family and my family. In my book, I wrote about a grandfather that I had that no one knew anything about. They knew he died in Philadelphia, and they knew he was murdered. Why? So about 3 years ago or more, I contacted the Philadelphia Library, who had 2 articles about his murder. Then I contacted, I tried to get as many contacts as I can. I finally got the police contact. And they had a record of what had happened. And so I found his grave, a potter's grave, with a little, what the hell are they called, the little daughters or little sisters of Mary or something, got him from the police station and buried him in this potter's grave. I don't know that my father even knew that. My father was in Italy when he was murdered. And my father came over here when he was like 21. I don't even think he knew about his father. Back to the DNA. I send the DNA. It comes back 93% Italian. The rest, North African, you know, whatever. I still didn't account for the red hair. Apparently, the red hair pops up every ogni tanto, they say. The red hair, just that if you have the right mixture, mother and father, the mutant gene pops up. Mm-hmm. But you can imagine me. I don't know if you read the story about.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I spent my whole life explaining that I wasn't Irish. But first of all, I didn't know what it was. They used to say Irish, and I thought it was something bad. I didn't know what that was at first. But So I think I just. Plus, I'm a history person anyway, but I'm thinking maybe if it wasn't for the red hair, I wouldn't have tried to do the research on it. Now, I've been to Italy, you know, I don't know, 30 times or so. I've been to Sicily for my wife's family, too. And they knew nothing about their family, absolutely nothing. Yeah. Anyway,
but you have the height too. Besides the red hair,
I shrunk now because I'm getting old.
Well,
but
yeah, who doesn't?
I was 6'2". That I just got the files from my father's military service. He was 5'4". He was 18 years old. He fought in the only. Engagement in the First World War that the Italians won. They fought at Vittorio Veneto and they beat the Austrians back. Years later, in the 70s, after he was in the United States, the Italian government found him and gave him a medal of whatever it was, Medaglia d'Oro, for. And he was knighted as the first class cavaliere because he fought in that thing. But he never said it. He never told me anything. I don't know if you had any experiences with people that have been in war. They don't say anything. It, you know, must not have been too much fun for them to repeat it. But and I'm still doing research for friends of mine. You know, the Italians are. I had two very good friends. They both were born in Africa. One was in Ethiopia, and one was in Tunis. You know, the Italians, before the wars, went over. I had an uncle that was killed in Eritrea in 1896, fighting the Ethiopians. And so my friends know nothing about their background because it was an Italian soldier that came over and got together with an Eritrean woman and the family started in Ethiopia. We don't even know. Anyway, I'm doing research on for him, too. I'm trying to find out about his grandfather.
Right. Now, so your father was born like in... 1880 or something like that, right?
1899. He was, you know, when they did a draft, you were chosen by your class. Your class was 1899. They brought up that whole class. So he was part of this group called the Ragazzi di 99, the boys of 99, because that's the group that beat back the Austrians at Vittorio Veneto. Yeah. Yeah, he was like 40-some when I was born. The interesting thing is my mother was 27 or so when she came over here with my brother. That was 1927. She was born in 1900.
Right. So, and I don't remember if it was a grandfather or an uncle that I get, was he in his 70s when he married a woman around 30 or something like that? Because my great grandfather was 60 when he married a woman 30. So
he This is my great grandfather. This is really a very weird story. I knew nothing about this guy. So I'm in Italy one time in the hometown. And I'm up in they call it a bar. It was a cafe. And there were a bunch of guys playing cards. And I said to the barista, I said, the guy was drinking. You know, in Italy, they drink those weird colored drinks, whatever they are. I don't know, these aperitifs or something. This guy was drinking a weird colored drink. And I pointed to him or to the drink. And I said, I said to the barista, come se chiama? Well, meaning, what do you call that drink? He said, oh, that's a Nesto Fumo. I said, Nesto Fumo? Who the hell? So I walked over to the guy and I said, you know, I introduced myself. I'm Robert Fumo, my father's Frank. And he didn't even bother. He was playing the game of poker. He just said, I'm your uncle. I said, what? You're my uncle. So I go back. I was staying with my mother, my father's sister at the time. And I go back and I said, I just met some guy in the bar upstairs. He says, he's my uncle. She says, oh, you met the Chucho. Like, what the? What is this all about? When I got back to America, I questioned my father. I said, who the hell is this guy, Ernesto? He said, he's my uncle because my father's grandfather, his wife died. He was 70-some years old. He married a 27-year-old. Had this Ernesto, and I guess it was a vergogna because they just discounted him. He lived in this small little town. And I said, nah, this can't be. This is ridiculous. I mean, what the hell did the guy have to do with the fact that he was born? Next time I went back, I took him out to lunch and, you know, kind of said, I accept you in the family. I don't know about the rest of the people, but weird story. Third time I went back, I went to my aunt looking for Zio Nesto. And they said, "È morto Zio Nesto." Oh, God, that's too bad. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard this term before, but his mantenuta is still around. I said, his mantenuta? The hell? Now, I know what mantenari means, to maintain. So it must have been his kept woman. So I said, yeah, I want to meet her. She came and said to me, you had a little mantenuta to your uncle. It's like it was nothing. Okay. So I don't know. There's a lot of weird stories that are in that book. The more you research, the more you find out the truth, because your parents don't tell you the truth. I mean, when you're 12 years old and you say, what about this? And they'll say, oh, they'll just say anything.
And you know, I don't even know how much they knew, because if their parents didn't tell them, of course, they wouldn't know. I didn't find out about my great-grandfather marrying a 30-year-old woman until, you know, again, I was doing research and I found his birth certificate. And it had, you know, my great-grandmother listed on there as his wife. And then 1913, I think it was, he married another woman. But I had no idea that I had cousins.
Relative.
From there.
Yeah.
So my father, I mean, we just met them in June. My father had a first cousin. Nobody ever said anything. I had no clue. The only thing my father said once was that he had family in Torre del Greco.
Outside of Naples.
Outside of Naples, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But he didn't say who, why, when, you know, nothing. And I know you mentioned in your book, you know, something about things don't happen by accident. You know, Nicola contacted me 2 months before we went to Italy. I'm your cousin. I'm going to meet you when you come to Italy. And then he brought me to his Zia. My father's first cousins also. Never knew these people existed. It's hard to believe.
Well, there is one story in my book. There was a story about my uncle, my mother's brother, who was captured at the Second World War, and he was in Albania. And when he came back from Albania, this is my mother's story. He found out that his wife had spoken to an American soldier that was coming through the town. So, I'm like skeptical anyway. Years later, I don't know if you've read this. I was working. I retired from Carnegie Hall. I was the director of real estate for Carnegie Hall, and I took like a part-time job managing a building in the Bronx in Riverdale. There was a problem one day with a guy spoke on his balcony, and it was whatever. So I called the guy, and to make a long story short, he went through this kind of like the same kind of background that I had. He was in the 9/11. He was there in 9/11, and so was I. He lost his wife to cancer, so did I. So, and he said, my mother-in-law lives with us, and she said that she knows that name, Fumo. I said, well, go up and ask her what town she came from. So he went up, he called me back up, and he said, she says she comes from Colliano. What? And then I hear her in the back saying, they ask him if his mother's Maria and his brother is Alberto. Man, I got on the elevator. I went up there. She comes out and says, oh my God, Cali Qual. He looks just like his uncle, who was her first boyfriend. Wow. Oh my God. I said, what the hell? Let's sit down. So I asked her the story about my uncle and his wife. She said, what? It wasn't because of the American with cigarettes. His wife took, thinking that he was dead in Albania, took up with another guy. So when he came back, the wife was, that was all around the town. And I said, come on, man. And anyway, he did forgive her because things, you're a young person and you think your husband's dead and the guy down the road is after you. You probably, I understand that, but my mother was dead by then, so I didn't get a chance to say, hey mom, why did you lie to me? But I'm sure she lied to me because she didn't like the story.
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com. Probably. Sure, it wasn't a good story. Do you know why they came to America? We know basically because they had to eat and everything like that. But is there any stories behind why they came? And
well, that's an interesting question because, as I said, he fought in the First World War. Before he went to war, he must have been 18. It said on his matriculation papers that he was a mechanical. I heard he told me that he worked for the railroad, which in Italy was a good job. You start with whatever you do, shovel coal in the steam engines, and then he worked his way up, and he was promised that after the war, he would have his job back, as they do here, I guess. When he got back to the little town, Colliano, his job, Italy was in shambles. Mm. In fact, he came right around the time that Mussolini marched on Rome. I'd like to think that's why he came, but I don't know that that's the thing. But the fact is, he came. How he got into the United States, it was pre 1924, so I think it was pretty easy to get into the United States at that time. He had an uncle in Newark. So he came to the United States and worked as a mechanic. Both my mother and father learned English very quickly. And I think, I wanted to do some research on this at one time. I think both he and his father, the guy that was murdered in, they could read and write. They were literate. My mother was in Italian. Mm-hmm. My mother was literate in Italian. She could read and write Italian. Most of the people, I don't know what the percentage was that came over, they were illiterate. So when you're illiterate in your language, it's harder to learn the new language, you know. But they, when I was born, my mother was speaking English, you know, with an accent. But and that was 1940. She came over 27. So 13 years, she was fluent in English. So I don't know that. I think there's a misnomer about the fact that the people come over here and they think it's the greatest thing in the world. They came over here for opportunity. My mother did not like America because she told me when she was in her 80s, I said, Mom, you know, you've been here all these years. What do you think of America? She said, no me piace. I said, well, you've been here so long, you know, you don't like it. I said, why? She said, you made it kind of so stupid. The Americans are stupid. Okay, now I don't know if they had problems. You know, they lived in an Irish neighborhood. I don't know whether there didn't seem to be a problem with a redheaded kid because everybody thought I was Irish anyway. So I never heard anything about my mother. Maybe they had problems. I don't
know. It's possible. Yeah, it's possible. Yeah, sure. And I know you talk in the book about the dialects and everything like that. You know, my parents, my father's family was from Naples. My mother's family was from Bari, and they used to fight all the time over who spoke the proper Italian.
No.
And the one thing that I learned over there, when we went to Calabria, you know, they spoke Italian, of course, you know, day-to-day
yes.
conversation.
Yes.
But when
yes.
they sang the song, they sang the song in a dialect. And
yes.
I asked them, I play a little bit of guitar, and I wanted to learn the song. And I said, could you send it to me? And it looks like no language I've ever seen in my life.
Well, Calabre? It was a Calabre style?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I don't know. Now, I met, actually, Monday night, I met a woman from Genoa. Whoa, that guy, obviously she was a young girl, so she spoke Italian. You know, she said, she speaks only Italian. I guess once in a while they go around and speak Genoese, but that's got to be totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the misnomer is that these people are speaking bad Italian. They're not speaking bad Italian. They're speaking dialect. When they came together and decided to use the Toscana dialect as the basic Italian, there was a discussion among the intellectuals, and I guess it was in the 1300s, or, you know, way back, whether they should use Sicilian or not, because Sicilian had poetry written. So it's not that there's good Italian and there's bad Italian. There's standard Italian and dialect. Everybody speaks standard Italian now. If you're under the age of 60, I think everybody speaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's what they were speaking. They were all, you know, they were all speaking Italian. But yeah, you know, because we went to several different regions, and you know, the dialects are all a little bit different. I mean, I know my mom's Bari's dialect is vastly different than you know the standard Italian. So I have to ask you because I had never heard of, is it Passyunk Avenue or Street? Heard of that. Yeah, never heard of that place until
Philly.
This past Sunday when I interviewed Rich Leto and Eric Lucera from there. And now it pops up again 5 days later. So tell me about South Philly and Passyunk Avenue.
Well, the funny thing is I went back and found the house where he lived. It was multi-family place, or what do you call it? But whatever, it's like a couple blocks from South Street in Philly. Those apartments are probably a couple thousand dollars a month now. You know, it's all yuppified.
Yeah.
But at that time, it was this boarding house. I don't know. I wish I knew. The guy that killed him was his partner. And from what I understand, they had an olive oil business where they delivered olive oil in Pittsburgh. And he fell down the stairs, but the partner. And I don't know my grandfather's story. We only know this story because my uncle went to visit this guy in jail and got this story. And my grandfather never took care of the guy. Then, to add insult to injury, he took up with the guy's ex-girlfriend. And that was too much for the guy. That's why he killed him. But he killed him in the middle of the street. Cop was right there and arrested him. But anyway, yes, past Young Avenue is in South Philly. It was the neighborhood of all Italians. It's now yuppified, or whatever the word is, gentrified.
Well, it's no different than Brooklyn. It's, same thing. I mean, those apartments, you can't touch those places anymore.
I know. I bought a house in Park Slope in 1979 for $40,000. I won't even tell you what I sold it for. Park, Yeah, Brooklyn went, well, anyway. Bensonhurst, it's all Chinese and Russian, I guess. I don't think there are many Italians left in Bensonhurst.
No, it's the same thing in Corona and a lot of the old neighborhoods. Most of the Italians are gone. My dad covered, he was a photographer for the Daily News for 40 years, and he covered Brooklyn he was in Brooklyn in the 50s and up until probably about 65, maybe. And then he covered Queens. So you saw his pictures in the paper, that's for sure, in the Daily News. And he's one of the few people that I know that really, really loved their job. He loved being on the street.
How did he get that job?
But that's an interesting story. He always wanted to be a photographer. And I guess he was 18 when the war broke out. And I guess in 42 or 43, he enlisted and he wanted to be a combat photographer. And they told him he was like a copy boy at the Daily News. And they told him he couldn't go right into photography because you had to be a professional photographer to be a combat photographer for the Army.
That makes sense.
He wasn't. So, but they told him they would send him to Signal Corps School in Monmouth, New Jersey. He got two stripes and a technical straw sergeant thing right out of boot camp. And they said, the life expectancy for a combat photographer is 6 months. So you'll get to do it eventually. Mm-hmm. But he had a punctured eardrum and they released him from the Army right after this gig in Fort Monmouth. And he went to the news, and because all the photographers were in the war, he became a photographer. So then what happened was when they came back and got their jobs back, he was a newsreel photographer for WPIX from probably about 46 to maybe 50 or 51. And then he started, then he was back on the, doing the photography, the still photography. But I tell people, everybody takes a picture these days. People don't understand the talent that these men had.
Yes, yes.
Taking those mm-hmm. pictures with a speed graphic, with two plates, and the shots my father had to carry around this big giant bag on his back with plates and flash bulbs. And
they held the flash bulbs. Yep. What did his father do?
Yeah, well, you see behind me, you see the Sorrentino hand embroidery sign there?
Yeah.
My grandfather and his brother, they had an embroidery shop in New York City.
Really?
And they made bridal veils and bridal gowns. And if I go this way, you see the little boy there, well, young man. That's my uncle. That's my father's brother. And the man in the hat is my grandfather's brother.
We'll be right back.
Are you a fan of global travel? Are you wanting to see more of the world yourself? Well, then you're my kind of people. My name is DeAndre Koch, and I'm the host of the travel podcast, Revolutionizing Your Journey, where we share stories of everyday people making the most of global travel and also teach you how to do the same yourself. You'll hear stories from people just like you who learned how to travel for nearly free, like Jo, who realized she could take her daughter to Disneyland in Tokyo for cheaper than in the US, or Rob, who flew his entire family of seven to Europe round trip in business class, all for less than the price of economy. Check out the link in the description for the Revolutionizing Your Journey podcast to learn how to elevate your own travels.
Now, how did he learn the business in Europe?
I have no idea. The only thing I could think of is my grandmother's aunt came in 1905 with her husband, and from what I learned, he had some kind of leather business. He either made shoes or he made wallets or something like that. And the only thing I could think of is that he, you know, war was breaking out, 1914, World War I was breaking out. The only thing I could think of is that they told my grandmother, if you come to America, maybe they would help them set up shop or whatever. But I don't really know the whole story. Because I don't think he did that in Italy. He was actually in the seminary, my grandfather. And he told the story that my grandmother would come past and flirt with him. But the real story apparently was she came from wealthy families. She was from two noble families. But her fancy dancy schmancy carriage broke down in front of the seminary and he was outside. He helped him repair it. They gave him a ride someplace, and that was that. That's a story.
There were definitely two groups of Italians that came over. There were the peasant group that came over that sapava la terra, and then there were the craftsman group, which mm-hmm. my father was a fabbro, and they definitely. Different, you know. I don't know how it's always. I talked to a woman the other day. I don't know if you ever heard the guy by the name of Idala, a lawyer. No. You don't remember a guy named Artie Idala that used to do Friday night fights?
No, I don't remember. But
okay, anyway, I talked to this kid Artie Idala, whose father was a famous lawyer. Defense lawyer in New York City, right? Called the Hat. He had a big mustache twisted up, and he did all the mafioso types, right? Anyway, I talked to him, and this is Monday night. I talked to him and his wife. You know, his wife went to Fordham. He went to NYU Law. Now that was not normal. You know, that was most of the Italians at that time. They were just interested in, you know, making money, not sending their kids to school. So the fact, and a woman, Sicilian woman, who went to Fordham and became a teacher, and then her husband, whose father actually was a fight guy, went to NYU law school. That's pretty good. I like those stories. And there's always a story about one guy in the family who, you know, the teacher comes in and says, hey, this kid's different than the rest of the kids in your family. You know, I'm going to take care of him. And the kid becomes a doctor and the rest of them are working construction or something. I like those stories. They're very interesting stories.
Well, yeah. And I interviewed Dr. Visco, who actually I didn't know when I first found him that we grew up in the same town, College Point in Queens. He's about 10 years older than me, probably about your age, roughly. And his grandfather, they were jewelers in Italy. But his grandfather painted on the ceiling of the bedroom medical book and something else medical. And he told his kids, you're going to be doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole family of either pharmacists or doctors. I mean, for the last 60 years.
Well, that was the big thing to become a doctor or a lawyer.
Yeah, yeah. And he instilled upon his kids, this is what you're going to do. You're going to read these books. You're going to do that. And they did it. It's an incredible story. I mean, Dr. Visco was the chief cardiologist, head of cardiology in Metropolitan Hospital in New York. He just retired, I guess, maybe 2 years ago or something like that. But yeah, and his mother was one of the very first female pharmacists in New York City. And they opened up a pharmacy in College Point. And, you know, when he's telling me these things that I didn't even know, I saw the picture and I said, I know that place. So it's amazing how these things, you know, sometimes come together and you find people that you never would expect to find. And I know you mentioned a little bit in the book about, you know, a couple of mafia type of things and stuff like that. And everybody thinks we're all mafia, which is crazy. But my dad, he used to take the Gallo brothers pictures all the time, usually coming out of court. and one day, Joey Gallo's coming out of court and my dad is taking his picture. And there was this guy that kept pushing the camera out of the way. Can't take a picture. So my father knew. I mean, he knew Joey Gallo. He knew him pretty well. And he said, Joey, I can't take a picture anymore. Don't worry about it. It was going to be taken care of. The following week, they found this guy in the trunk of a car.
The guy that blocked him. you know.
And my father says, I have no idea. He said, I hope it wasn't because of me.
A lot of these mafiosi, I don't know if you've ever heard of Poly Prep in Brooklyn.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I taught in Poly Prep from 78 to 82. And it was half Jewish and half Italian. I don't know how many of the Italians were from mafioso families. Paul Castellano, I don't know. He was anyway. The point was that their fathers, like Castellanos and the big mafioso guys, did not want their kids. For the most part, they did not want their kids in that business. And I had these kids who were freaking smart. They went to Columbia. They went to because the father said no way or. Somebody said, no way you're going to go in that kind of business. So, the guys that were in the mafia, they were bright guys. They just, that was their way to make money, but they didn't want, it's not like the Godfather. Actually, the Godfather, though, he did send them to college.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
But they're interesting stories, too.
It was so funny when my father told us that story because we were like, what? But, you know, he liked to have his picture in the paper like Gotti, you know, the same kind of thing.
Yeah, sure. Teflon Don.
Yeah. He loved it. And I know I've mentioned this on a couple other podcasts. The differences in Italian food, because you've been there so many times, so you know probably better than most of us. But people don't understand, you know, even Italian Americans, they don't understand. And we got a real feeling for that when we were there for 2 weeks. The food, Italian food here is not Italian food in Italy.
No. And what people don't realize, okay, my mother comes over here in 1927. The cuisine from 1927 to 2022, it's changed in Italy dramatically. You know, because the Italians, the one thing about the Italians is they love creativity. So they love the idea of creating new things in food. So you go over there, I mean, no one's eating baked ziti. I don't even know. And some of the other things, like the one I like is chicken parmigiano. They don't have that. That doesn't exist. The chicken. But speaking to this Genovese person, and she was saying the same thing. She was saying I said I lived in Austria. She said, oh, the food is terrible. It's true. You can't even compare the Italians. Okay, I'm a little prejudiced, but everybody says that. Non-Italians say that you can't compare the Italian food to anything else. It's the best. And when you come back, you got to find a restaurant that at least matches it a little bit, you know? We do have one around here where I have a place in Bucks County that I think I talked about it. It's yeah. Close.
I know. And what I love there is when we were in Montebello in the mountains there, everything was made by them. The cheese, the ham, the wine,
everything,
the olive oil.
Everything.
And you know, it's just so incredibly good and fresh and everything. And it was funny because, you know, then Ross, like breakfast especially, you know, they don't need ham and eggs and things like that. But to your point about living in Austria, we lived in England for 2 years.
It's what brutal. Year?
We were there from late 94 to late 96.
I remember going there in the 60s and 70s. It was brutal, is right. You had to go to like a foreign restaurant. I think it's a little better now. I mean, I don't know.
Because well, you know, there are some things. I should have bashed it completely. Like we would like going to the pubs on Sunday. Because they would have like a 3-course roast meal, like roast beef or roast pork or roast turkey. And that was always good. You get a little starter and you have the roast and then the dessert. And it was cheap. It was like £5.50. And it was, you know, good value for the money. I used to cook for, you know, my English friends over there. And they were like, how did you learn to make this? Because I was cooking, you know, our American Italian food, like eggplant parmesan and parmesan and things like
which
that.
Which is good. It's not that it's bad food. It's just not the same as the one in Italy. It's not as good. I said to this girl the other night, I said, the Alto Grill on the Autostrada in Italy is better than most Italian-American restaurants. The Alto Grill, everybody says that. They get off on the Alto Grill. And it's unbelievable. They can't govern themselves, but they can do everything else perfectly, the Italians. They can't govern themselves. They never have been able to govern themselves because of their history. You know, that they've only been, how long have they been to Italy? 150 years?
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
And it was just the time. I think the one of got up all these men.
But you know, who cares if they can govern themselves or not? Because the food is great, the people are great, the scenery is great.
Exactly.
Who cares?
It doesn't. The government doesn't bother me when I. If you're rich in Italy, it is unbelievable because you have everything in the world that you need. You want to go skiing? Okay, go skiing. You want to go to the beach? Okay, which we go? Which side you going to go? Anything you want to do. You want to go to? You ever go to Matera?
No, we were gonna go, and then we had to change the trip around. But I hope we're gonna go next year and get there.
That's an unbelievable town. Mm. And the story, you know, it was written by a guy named Carlo Levi, who was a Jew. That's the other thing that people don't know what the Jews in Torino were like. This was a high class group of people who were Italian. You know, yeah, they were Jewish religion or whatever, culturally Jewish, but they were Italian. Well, they got screwed by Mussolini, but only because of circumstances, you know.
Well, you know, I interviewed a guy from up that way, Jewish, and he didn't know he was Jewish until he was 30 years old.
I heard that story before. Yeah. I had my friend from Rome says he played with kids. He never knew they were Jewish, so they got married. No, yeah. They're Italian. Well, it's a pretty easy to meld into the Italian culture. I mean, it's not exactly a hard, not a rigorous culture. You know, you go to cafes and I gave a speech once when I was teaching about being Italian. And it has nothing to do. There's no race. There's no Italian race, as I can attest to being a redhead. It's a cultural thing. And some of the best Italians are not Italian. You know, but they've adopted that lifestyle. They live in Italy, and
They're Italian now.
Well, you know, and I've seen these people, they've done the DNA test, and then it comes back, they're 50% Italian and 30% this and 20% Greek, and they're all bent out of shape over it. And I tell them, that's just your DNA. That's, you know, that's different from your culture. Of course, you know, your culture is Italian because that's where your grandparents and great-grandparents, exactly, that's where everybody lived. But, you know, why are you getting bent out of shape because you have 20% Greek in you? Half of Italy has 20% Greek in them. So.
Exactly, especially Sicily. Sicily, Arab and Jewish, you know. I have a little bit of Ashkenazi Jews.
Yeah, me too.
This was a peninsula that everyone went to, you know, starting from way back when. Of course, young people went there, young guys went there, they met young girls, and they had kids. And that's why it's a great mixture. That's why the Italians and the Sicilians are so strong, because they're mixed. It's like the strongest dogs are the mixed dogs, you know?
And that's why the food is so good too, because the food is a mixture of every culture. Depending on where you are in a peninsula, it's completely different.
I mean, you could get Arab kind of food in Sicily that's delicious, you know? Oh yeah. Oh well, we're bragging, Bob.
That's okay. We're allowed to. We're Italian. That's what we do.
That's true. I said I have relatives. The Italians love to give each other accolades. Oh, you know, man of the year and this and that. And, you know, they love other people and they love to say, you're doing really great. I mean, my cousins always used to say, oh, Bobby, you're so great. You're so good. Now, I mean, I can't imagine an Englishman or an Irishman saying that to one of their relatives. You know, anyway.
I think it's the comedian Sebastian. I think it was Sebastian Maniscalco who said, you know, growing up, they would say, you know, what are you? I'm 100% Italian. And what are you? I'm half Italian, half embarrassed.
Well, my wife is half Italian and half Polish. Obviously, the Italian culture took over. She doesn't know anything about being. I don't want to demean Polish culture, but. If you have a choice between those cultures, it's a little hard to go up against the Sicilian culture, especially. It's a hard, you know, yes, most people would take that culture. Anyway.
Yeah. My wife she's half Sicilian and half Puerto Rican, so.
Oh, that's a great mixture. Oh, God.
Now I cook the rice and beans and I cook the Italian food and, you know, so I've had to learn to adapt a little bit as far as how to make pork Puerto Rican style and Italian style, and how to make rice and beans.
Thank you for interviewing me, Bob.
Oh, no, it was my pleasure. Great story. So before we go, is your book available? Can people buy it?
I guess, yeah. I guess you could go online and buy it. I don't even know. I should try and see if I can buy it, because I wrote it years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think you should. If they can't, you need to make it. You need to do it so they could buy it. In fact, I could tell you who to send it to, but it's a great book, great stories in there. And I you know, really, really enjoyed all the stories in there. So we need to get it out to people to read.
All right, Bob.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.